Hey, welcome everybody to Spirituality Adventures. We're glad you're tuning into this episode. We are a viewer and listener supported podcast, so we really appreciate you listening, watching on YouTube. We really encourage you to subscribe to whatever platform you're using. If you're on YouTube, hit that subscribe button, or if you're on Apple or however you listen to a podcast, be sure and subscribe. We greatly appreciate it. Also, make comments if you like it and share it if you like it. We really need people to make comments and share the episodes that you like. And then also, if you're not already a supporter, we really would encourage you to go to spiritualityadventures.com and you can pick a tier, and we have bonus content for every type of giver. This is a nonprofit, so they're tax deductible donations, but we do provide bonus content for those who are supporters. So be a part of the team, help support Spirituality Adventures. And we're so glad you're tuning into this episode. All right. Hey, welcome everybody to Spirituality Adventures. Glad you're tuning into this episode. And today I have Colby Martin. And Colby is an author, a speaker, a pastor, a worship leader. And I have been trying to get a hold of Colby now for about 2.5 years, and it finally happened, finally connected. So thank you, Colby, for jumping on Spirituality Adventures and doing this interview today.
Well, thanks for not giving up on me, Fred. We've just been letting the meat marinate for 2 years. Right, so right. It's now tender. We're going to just fall off the bone here. It's going to be a wonderful time. So thanks for having me.
You bet. So I always like to start with just some of your background, your origin story, like where were you born, where you grew up? Give us a little bit of your family origin, your faith background.
And yeah, sure.
Take us into kind of like your post high school career in church life. It sounds like, from what I've read from Unclobbered, and what I've heard from, snippets from here and there that I've gathered from your story.
Yeah. Good. So yeah, again, thank you. So I grew up in Oregon, a small town called Albany, Oregon, about 40,000 people or so. And I was the middle child of three boys. My dad comes from a long line of Baptists and Mennonites. And then my mom was a first generation Christian when she met my dad. And so we grew up going to church multiple times a week for choir practice and Sunday school and youth group. And that was our rhythm. It was called First Baptist Church in Albany, Oregon. So I'm a recovering Baptist. Okay. And my parents got a divorce around the time I was, 7, 8, 9. Memory's a little bit fuzzy. And it was also a long drawn out process, as my therapist can attest to. Upon the divorce, the Baptist church, I think, back then this would have been the late 80s, early 90s. Divorce was still really like a big scary thing. And so they didn't really know how to handle this family that had now been fractured. So there's a point where my mom tried to keep my brothers and myself going to that church for a little while after the divorce. But eventually, I think she was just ready for a fresh start. And so she took us to a different church in town. And this was just kind of a generic evangelical church. And that was really my formative years then in high school. And I tell you that because everything changed, but I would just go to youth group and go to church, but it wasn't really something I took all that seriously. But all of that changed for me, Fred, the summer going into my senior year of high school, when I accompanied my youth pastor and about 10 students. We drove from Oregon down the coast to Southern California, and we attended a week-long conference called SEMP, S-E-M-P, which stands for Students Equipped to Minister to Peers. And the idea of SEMP was that they would train high school students in the art of apologetics. And for the listeners who don't know, apologetics is a fancy word that means I'm right and you're wrong, so let me try to prove it to you. And they would train us in the morning on how to do like random street witnessing and just talk to people about Jesus and salvation. And then they would send us out 2 by 2 on the beaches of Southern California to just do random street witnessing to people. And I remember that first afternoon going out, you know, interrupting people who were just trying to have a nice vacation on the beach, and like interrupting them with, excuse me, do you know if you were to die right now, where you would go? Which is just the most abrasive, like disruptive question you could ask someone. Like, if you were to die right now, I'm like, oh, well, what's about to happen? Where would you go? And
thousands of times, Colby. So anyway,
And you look back at it now and it's like, man, it's so hard for me to connect with that version of myself who thought that that was a good idea. And maybe I never thought it was a good idea. I don't know. But the point is I came back from that first morning. Yeah. Right. That first morning on the beach, and I got back to my room and I remember falling down on the bed in the dorm room and just weeping. And, you know, I'm kind of an easy cry now, but back then, I mean, I was not, I don't know. I don't remember the last time I would have cried before that. But I just felt so broken. And the only way I can describe it is that I felt incredibly exposed, as a fraud. Because I was out there telling people about how to have a relationship with God through Jesus when I really didn't have any of that myself to speak of. So I really felt this fracturing of who I was pretending to be with who I really, really was on the inside. And that sort of disintegration, not being integrated, ruptured me. It broke me in a way that I'd never experienced before. And there was this sense that I felt, and this is kind of how I would have described it back then. I might use different words for it now, but I'll just stay in the narrative. I heard God say to me, not in an audible sense, but in a way that I just sort of knew was happening. Essentially, I wasn't being invited to go down one of two paths. And one path was just the path that I was on, which was life was kind of all about me and trying to be cool and trying to bring all the attention to myself. And I could keep doing that, or I could use this moment as a turning point, right? Later I would have the word repentance to kind of put on this experience where the metanoia, the changing of the mind, the changing of the direction, the reverse course, I could choose a different path and make my life about something more than just me. And at that time, I would have said, you know, make my life about God, bringing glory to God. And for reasons that I'm not entirely sure, I guess we just call it grace. That's the path I chose in that moment. I decided, yeah, I want to make my life about more than just me. And so I used that week as a significant turning point in my life. Eventually, a couple nights later, I felt this calling to go into ministry, which, you know, again, looking back, the cynical side of me is like, well, that's just because you were a sort of a charismatic, smart, popular kid. And so you were in a tradition that just awarded people that looked like you and talked like you. So of course you'd be a pastor. Like, whether I actually had the gifts for it or tools for it, it was irrelevant. It was just like, here's a guy that fits the profile. So, you know, maybe that's the only reason why I thought I'd be a pastor, but still I decided to be a pastor. And so I abandoned my plans to be a graphic designer back on the East Coast. And I enrolled in a Baptist college and got my degree in pastoral ministry and
college.
Yeah. And there I was. I was on the path towards rising an evangelical in that sort of subculture. And
yeah,
it was all set to be a really great leader in that world.
Sure. What college did you attend?
Well, at the time, it was called Western Baptist College in Salem, Oregon. But shortly after I graduated, they changed their name officially to Corbin University.
Okay.
They wanted to appeal, I guess, to beyond just Baptists. So
yeah, I remember I've heard of that school. Not super connected to it. Was it more of a independent Baptist, fundamental Baptist, or was it more of a,
it was
American Baptist, more of a liberal Baptist type school, or
no, it wasn't Southern. It might've been like general GAR. Yeah. I don't know. It's been a minute, but it was definitely conservative Baptist.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So you had some coming out of college, you started into ministry as a worship leader.
Yeah, that's right.
Not a pastor, right?
Yeah.
And where did that Where did that take you? Because you open up your Unclobbered book. So by the way, audience, we're the first book that Colby wrote and the one we're really focusing on today is called Unclobbered. And he's dealing with the six, quote, clobber passages of the Bible that that we traditional Christians have used to call any kind of homosexual activity sinful, right? And so, as I think my audience knows, I've interviewed a lot of people now over the last 3 years, and I pastor an open and affirming church now. And, but that's been a process of change over my pastoral career as well. And so you open up in Unclobbered as a worship pastor at a conservative church where you're re-examining your beliefs around the LGBTQ plus community. And re-examining the six passages in the Bible. So you're a worship pastor and you basically get because of your position that you arrived at, which we're going to dive into here in a minute, you were asked to leave the church. So how did you get like from college to, did you start right into ministry full time as a worship pastor?
I did. Yeah. So in college, the typical track at that point was be a youth pastor and then be a senior pastor. And I think I did maybe 1 week of youth ministry classes and I realized, wait a minute, I don't like kids. I don't want to work with kids. This is absurd. So then I switched to just kind of a general pastoral ministry degree. But while I was in college, I learned to play guitar and I developed a singing voice and I learned that, oh, I've got kind of a unique skill set for what that subculture of Christianity, you know, calls worship leading. Right. So, which I assume most of your audience is familiar with. I don't need it. Yeah. You know, sometimes in the mainline world, I'll need to be a little more, you know, explanatory about what that means. But I think
most people know me as Vineyard Fred, you know, so anyway.
Yeah. So you definitely get it. Yeah, I noticed I was really good at creating spaces and opportunities and avenues for people to connect with God through the art of music. And so coming out of college, that was where I got my first couple pastoral jobs, was in the worship and arts ministry. And right out of college, I got a job at a mega church up in Salem, Oregon as their associate worship pastor. Cause I was just a young, you know, 24 year old kid who was just cutting his teeth in that world. And about a year after working there, I was asked by my younger brother and his fiance if I would officiate their wedding ceremony, which meant I needed to get licensed as a pastor so that I could officially do the ceremony. So I went about the process of getting licensed in that church that I was working at. Now that church, I talked about my Baptist background, but that church was actually part of the CMA, the Christian Missionary Alliance denomination. Yeah. And so there was a very specific license process to go through that involved, you know, a lot of essays and questionnaires. And it culminated with this interview in front of a panel of seasoned ministers where they would sort of determine, you know, will we stamp you with being a pastor in our denomination? And I remember, Fred, there was this one afternoon where I was on my lunch break studying, getting prepped for this interview. And I was reading over the denomination's policies and procedures manual to kind of familiarize myself with how the church was structured and what the rules were and all that. And there was this moment where I was walking through the church lobby where I read this portion of the manual that said something to the effect of practicing homosexuals cannot be members of the church. Mm. Now, at the time, I was firmly rooted in the traditional, historical, conservative view on sexuality. Like, my theology was, being gay is a sin. It's not God's design, et cetera, et cetera. So I didn't have any problem with that per se, but when I read that line, I noticed my heart ached. There was this sense of, oh, sure. That's the theology is right. But wait, like they can't be members of a church. And I kept reading and I talked about all the roles that they couldn't serve in, right? They could be greeters, they could be parking lot attenders, but they sure as heck can't serve in children's ministry or be in leadership. And that was the first time that I noticed what I then later described as this lack of alignment between my head and my heart. They were in different places. Mm-hmm. Earlier, I mentioned that the experience on the as a student in the beaches of Southern California, made me aware of being disintegrated with my internal self and my external pretending. Mm-hmm. And now this was sort of a further disintegration, but of my head and my heart. And so I didn't do much with that at that moment. I just noticed, oh man, I do not feel, this doesn't make me feel good. Like, I don't like how this makes me feel, but this is what the theology is. So you got to go with it. And I just sort of sat with that tension for a number of years, because I didn't really have an impulse or a catalyst or a reason to explore it at that time. Like, I didn't have any that I knew of. I didn't have any gay friends or family members that were sort of forcing me to address the matter more directly. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of people, that's their story, is they have a brother, they have a sister, they have an aunt who comes out to them or somehow just forces them to like reevaluate their theology because they stare at this person that they love, who says that they are still a Christian and yet they're also gay. And so the person has to sort of make a choice. What do I do with that? Yeah, I didn't have that necessarily. I just had this lack of alignment. Like, that's interesting. Like, I should maybe one day, I'll explore that. And then fast forward another year or so, and I end up moving from Salem down to take a job outside of Phoenix, Arizona, at a evangelical church there as their pastor of worship and arts. And shortly after moving there, I kind of continued this journey of auditing my faith, which is a term that I use. A lot of people now use the term deconstruction. Isn't a term that I used back then. I don't even know that people were saying this was back in 2007, 2008. So that's not a word that I necessarily connect with per se. For me, it was more of an exploration. It was like an auditing of my faith. Like, I sometimes picture a Jenga tower. And you know how in Jenga, you got these blocks all along the bottom that you carefully tap out and then you put it up top. Well, I was carefully sort of bringing out these different beliefs and asking questions about it. And like, how has the church historically taught about this? Because it was shortly after college, Fred, that I realized, wait a minute, there have been myriad different approaches to Christianity for the last 2000 years. Mm-hmm. Because Baptists have this mentality, and I wonder if Vineyard do too, that it kind of goes Jesus, Peter, Paul, skip a bunch of stuff, and then you have Baptists. Like this unbroken line of perfect theology. But I realized, oh man, there's all sorts of theological diversity.
For Vineyard, is Jesus, Paul, and then the Jesus movement.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. So yeah, this is sort of unbroken strain of perfection. But it turns out like Christianity has been rife with diversity of thought for a long time. So anyway, I'll pause and throw it back to you. But that's the point in my journey where I began to audit these. I'd pull out these Jenga blocks of belief. I'd get curious about them. I'd ask questions about them. Sometimes I'd put them back on, be like, all right, I'm going to hold on to this, but it's going to be different. I'm going to turn it a little bit. And then other times I would like, I can't hold this anymore. This belief has to go. This isn't congruent with who I see in Jesus. It's not congruent with the larger picture of the Bible. It's not congruent with the world that we live in. So that was kind of, you know, that was the experience of me going through this auditing of my evangelical heritage.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. I think for me, I was pastoring people who were LGBTQ+. And when we started the Vineyard, my goal was to reach people outside the church in a grace-based environment, right? In a non-traditional environment, you know, rock and roll and the Bible and Jesus kind of all together. And so I, from day one, I had LGBTQ people in my church, but all of us were from conservative backgrounds. So we all thought it was sin, but we also, I didn't think it was sin any different than my sin. So I wasn't going to not extend grace. And Exodus International was going on, and this was a ministry led by like ex-gay Christians to help gay Christians become straight, right? Through a process of inner healing.
Yeah.
That would, and once you got inner healed enough, the idea was that then you wouldn't be gay anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. There's actually some good components to the inner healing. So I had my LGBTQ people in the early days of Vineyard in the 90s were a part of our leadership team with what we called groups that were leading relational healing and broken, you know, relationship stuff.
Yeah.
Of us thought of, you know, and so they were leading the healing groups, right? And then after a decade, nobody really got straight. And then it didn't work. Yeah. And then they hated themselves worse because they hadn't made any progress. Hardly.
That's right. That's right.
So that's then I started sort of backing off of that and then still trying to figure out, the things that we couldn't do in Vineyard was do a gay wedding or ordain a gay person that was an open gay lifestyle. But if a person was willing to, you know, if they were gay, but willing to be celibate, then they could be in leadership. Right. So that was the game I was playing in, you know, through the 90s and then into the 2000s, but always trying to reexamine the passages. And so I now pastor an open and affirming church for the last year and a half. And a lot of people have visited from my Vineyard church, but it's clear that it's open and affirming. So I've had dozens and dozens and dozens of conversations with former members of my Vineyard church about open and affirming, why that's my position now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's been painful because a lot of people have rejected. I've lost a lot of support financially, people who were supporting Spirituality Ventures and then stopped because of that. Mm. It's been a really interesting. So I've been referring everybody to your book, Unclobbered. You really took the time to dig into these six clobber passages. By the way, and that's where I kind of want to go. I actually want to take like little sound bites here over the next few minutes that we have and just give each of those six clobber passages your quick result of your study. Okay.
Sure.
Just because I know there's people listening that they really care about the Bible. They want to be true to the Bible.
Of course.
I think there's also lots of people like you, like me, who feel like their head and their heart aren't aligned there because they had, like me, I was pastoring people I loved who were in the queer community. I have friends, two of my close conservative friends have kids now that are in the queer community. So they've had to re-examine, you know, it's happening all over the place where people are having to re-examine these beliefs, and yet they don't want to be unfaithful to the Bible. That's still a crowd that's out there that listens to me. I have another part of my crowd that's come on board with me also that maybe aren't Christians or ex-Christians or Buddhists or any number of things that never really had those hangups, you know, like we conservative Christians.
Yeah. Did.
So they easily moved into an affirming position, but you've done a great job. Thank you for doing the book Uncovered. And I love the way you kind of started with your own story and then dove into exegesis and then went back to your story and then dove into exegesis and then back, you know, so it's a great job. Thanks for doing
Thanks, Fred.
I think it's a good service to the Christian community. So yeah, let's do that. You were at this conservative church in Phoenix. You were leading.
Yeah.
Your head and your heart weren't aligned. You started re-examining these clobber passages. Who coined the term clobber passages?
I couldn't find it. Okay. I couldn't find it when I was doing my research. So, yeah, there was a point when I was auditing these various components of my belief system and I can't remember the final impetus that pushed me toward addressing that tension that between my head and my heart that it had existed for a number of years. But there was, yeah, for some reason, I'm like, all right, that's, I gotta figure out that one. And I didn't know going into my study, because prior to really looking into it, I think I did what most Christians do, which is just take some assumptions that have been passed on explicitly or implicitly, which is, oh, the Bible's clear, homosexuality is a sin. That story of Sodom and Gomorrah, that was, you know, God destroyed a city because of gay people. There's something about it being an abomination. I remember reading that on a picket sign, so that's got to be true. And then in the New Testament, you know, I think Paul calls it unnatural, or you can't be gay and Christian, right? We just have all these kind of one-liner assumptions that have been given to us that with, you know, without really looking into it, it just kind of sounds like, yeah, that's settles the matter. What else is there to say on it? And so when I began to really look into the matter and decide for myself, I didn't know where the research was going to take me. Like, I didn't know if my head was going to come out on the other side convinced, oh yeah, the historical traditional perspective is correct. So sorry, heart, you're going to have to figure out how to get in line. Or if maybe I would discover that my heart was in the right place and my head was the thing that had to move. And obviously that is what ended up happening. But in terms of where the term, so when I was studying this back in 2009 or 10, whatever it was, I remember coming across that term and it just intuitively like, I get what that's saying, and I also hate it, right? Because the idea is that it is, these verses have been used, and I would say misused, to clobber, to really attack, to minimize, to demean, to dehumanize gay people for so many years. But as far as the origin of the term, I don't know where it came from. But I knew that once I started writing about it, just this term unclobber is the one that came to me. I'm like, all right, I'm going to undo, like, I'm going to take the teeth out of these passages. And really, not by dismissing them. I mean, that's what's interesting about this, right? Is I was trained in the evangelical world. You mentioned the term, exegesis. I was trained to go into the heart of a thing and to explore the context of it, the historical, the cultural context. I was trained how to look at the original languages and understand what, as best as we can, what the original intent of the authors were. So I was using the tools that I was trained in. I didn't want to just look at these six passages and say, well, this just kind of seems uncomfortable, so we're just going to ignore them. Or these are just old, so they don't have anything to do with us today, so let's just ignore them. No, like, I wanted to actually go through the heart of these things, because I think you can. I think you can go right into the heart of these things and discover on the other side, not only do they not say what I think we've always been told that they said, but actually they even sort of ironically or beautifully open up a pathway to a kind of faith expression that actually is more open, more generative, more gracious, even more inclusive, which is just super fun. Like, these passages sometimes even say, I won't say they say the exact opposite, but I just mean they point in a direction that actually puts a person on a trajectory towards more inclusion, as opposed to using these for exclusion. Yeah.
Yeah. So Sodom and Gomorrah, that's the first clobber passage that you deal with.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is that about? Give us your short, because I want to tick down through each of these six.
For sure. Yeah. And I'll say it like this. In the ancient world from which these stories came from, there was a way to, characterize sort of the goodness of a tribe of people. There's a way to paint the morality of a culture that looked like this. If you were good, essentially, then you were hospitable towards outsiders. And if you were wicked or evil, then you were not hospitable. You were, so it's a bit hard for us, or it's really hard for us in our modern sensibilities, especially because this word hospitality that I'll use, we tend to think of it as you know, making sure that when guests come over, that the vacuum, we vacuumed the rugs, and maybe there's some nice music playing on in the background, and we've got drinks prepared and appetizers. Like, we think of hospitality in kind of this surface level way, but in the sense that these ancient cultures thought of them, it was like a deep provision for the outsider. It was a caring for others in a way that like gave them humanity. This was really, really, really important. And so the ancient Israelite people, when they were set about the task of, you know, trying to illuminate to the world who Yahweh was, who their God was, they'd have these stories that had kind of been with them for a really long time as a way to articulate not only who their God was, but who they were called to be in the world. And I say all that because we actually have multiple versions of this kind of story from antiquity. And when I say this kind of story, I mean, we have multiple versions of stories where divine figures show up sort of clothed, you know, as pretend humans to a well-known and well-established wicked city to see if there was anybody in the city worth saving, because the gods had decided that this place is so wicked that they were going to be destroyed. And so in these stories, there would be these individuals who showed hospitality and care to these divine figures dressed as humans, and they were the ones that got to be spared, whereas the rest of the city was destroyed. So in the book, I talk about Balkis and Philemon, which comes, you know, from a different heritage of antiquity, and you read this story and it just sounds exactly like Genesis 19, Sodom and Gomorrah. And so the point here is that Sodom and Gomorrah and Genesis 19, this was like the ancient Hebrews version of this story. It was their way to talk about the call to be hospitable. And so in this story, which has nothing to do with sexuality, in this story, you have the character of Lot, who takes in these visitors, these angelic beings, right? He takes them into his home and provides for them and cares for them, gives them great hospitality, and is met in the middle of the night by all the men in the city who come to do what the men of Sodom did, which was exercise their authority and their power and their aggression. They were there to show these outsiders, like, look, you're in our city now. We're gonna make you ours. We're gonna dominate you. And so the story, if this story has anything to do with sex, Fred, then I guess what you could say is it kind of has a negative view of gang rape.
Yeah, that's
which correct. I think is fair to say. Like, I don't think anyone is out there is arguing that that shouldn't be condemned. No, that is something that should be condemned, right? This is
in prisons, right?
Yeah, like the men of Sodom, they weren't wanting to have like a consensual committed. They weren't wanting to like have a romantic, intimate connection with these angelic beings. No, they just wanted to humiliate, dominate, abuse them, and Lot refused to let them have it. So anyway, what we can say about this story, and then what I love and what I'm quick to point out is that we're not left to our own devices to try and understand how the Jewish people thought of Sodom and Gomorrah, because you have biblical writers later on in the history of Israel look back and sort of recall. Remember that story we would tell about Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, here, like Ezekiel and Isaiah and Jeremiah, they would say, well, here was the sins of Sodom. Here's how these stories live on as a reminder, because they had so much and they didn't care. They didn't use their vast resources to care for others. In fact, they oppressed others, and they were wicked towards the outsider. And even Jesus, when he referenced Sodom and Gomorrah, again, it was in the context of hospitality. He was telling his disciples, go announce the kingdom of God village by village. And if people receive you, that's great. But if they reject you, then it's going to be better for Sodom and Gomorrah than for them. You know, it's like that was the context. It wasn't about sexuality at all. So Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, is one of those clobber passages where all you got to do is just read the story with an open mind, and you pretty quickly can observe, oh, this has nothing to do about homosexuality. Sexual orientation has nothing to do with people being in a loving, committed relationship of the same sex.
Yeah. All right. Let's go. Give me really short bullets on these. And because I know, I want,
oh, come on. That was really short. What are you talking about?
Unclobbered. I want everybody to read the, each. Yeah. You have a chapter basically on each of these six.
Yeah. Passages. Yeah. That's right.
And you do a deep dive on the context and the history and even the languages, right? The words and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Just give enough of a tease here. Cause I have several other things I want to get to beside these six
things. I hear you. Yeah. Okay. So go even tighter. We can do this.
Yeah. Leviticus has two passages, Leviticus in 18 and Leviticus 19, that talks about men sleeping with men, right? Or bedding, whatever. But you focused in on to'eva, which is this word that gets translated abomination.
Yeah.
So give us what are those two passages about?
And yeah, this
to'eva.
Yeah, this Hebrew word that gets translated into our English Bibles as abomination. I think that translation is actually what's abominable here, because I think that the English word abomination, it has synonyms like vile, gross, subhuman. Like, this is what abomination means, but tova doesn't not mean those things. Like, that's not what, that wasn't the usage of the intent or the purpose of this term. Rather, this term was a way to subjectively, by the way, to subjectively articulate that certain cultural practices for one group of people could be considered taboo or unclean or uncouth to another group of people. It was a way of sort of demarcating, these things are what we do and those things are what you do. And for the Israel people, being separate, which is a set apart, which is another way to talk about being holy, for them being their own distinct people group, that again, their calling was to illuminate who Yahweh was, to reveal to the world who their God was. For them, it was very important that they be set apart, that they be different than, in the context of when Leviticus was written, different than the Egyptians from whom they were just freed from, and different from the Canaanites where they were heading to and to for the promised land. Yeah. And so the book of Leviticus, which really was written for the tribe of Levi, so there's a sense in which you could say none of the book of Leviticus has anything to do with any of us, because none of us are tribes of, well, not none of us, but most of us are not tribes of Levi. And so in these passages where there's descriptions of thing after thing after thing that is described as tova, you notice that some of these things, yeah, they have a moral impetus to it. Like, don't sacrifice your children to Molech, to the foreign god Molech. Yeah, that's kind of immoral, right? But other things that are considered tova, they don't really have what we might call a moral sense to it. Like, mixing seeds in your garden, like don't grow different things together, or don't mix fabrics together, or don't eat certain kinds of fish or certain kinds of food. Like, these were things that were considered tova, that were considered cultural practices that the Hebrew people wanted to abstain from. And the error is when we look at these practices and we take this word tova and we put this moral objective layer on it, and we say these are things that are always wrong for all time for all people. And what's uniquely being described, and I talk about this in the book, in these two passages in Leviticus, again, I would argue, and I do argue, don't have anything to do with sexual orientation. So again, what we sort of think of today as classically people who are gay or lesbian or bisexual, what we're naming is we're naming this phenomena where people are primarily or solely attracted to and desire relationships with people of the same sex. So we have term like homosexuality is a term we have now as a way to talk about this phenomenon, as a way to name that some people are only attracted to people of the same sex. These passages in Leviticus have zero connectivity to that phenomena. This is not about people's sexual orientation. And so in the book, I describe what I think is going on here when the Hebrew says that a male shall not lie with a male, the lyings of a wife, for it is tova. Again, first we look at tova. We're not even talking about this sort of objectively a moral thing. We're saying it's just culturally off limits for the Jewish people. And then even then, what is the actual thing that's being described? I think it has to do more with the context of the whole passage of Leviticus 18, which is about violation of family boundaries and losing a sacredness for those relationships.
Yeah. Excellent. Go to the book, folks, read the whole book, and particularly these passages. If you've ever wondered in your own heart, is the Bible really against, you know, people's sexual orientation, who they love? Is that really what it's all about? These six passages, yeah. Then go do a great job. So then let's jump to the New Testament. We've got the Romans passage and then the 1 Corinthians 6, 9 and 10 and the 1 Timothy 1, 10. Give us a quick summary of those New Testament passages. The Romans one, probably dealing with pedophilia, right? Or at least this
not as I understand it.
Okay. More of the Roman practice of, well, anyway, you describe what you'd see there. And then the other one is you dissect this word that's been translated homosexual.
Yeah.
But probably isn't the best translation. Arsenicoitai.
Yeah. No, definitely not a good translation to put. So 1 Corinthians 6, 9 and the 1 Timothy, those are pretty identical in terms of their construction. So I treat those as kind of the same. Paul's doing the same thing here. But yeah, to take this Greek word arsenicoitai, which Paul probably made up, right? Because it's the first instance that we have, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with Paul, you know, making up words, but he was clearly trying to point to something here. But to suggest that thing, as some translations do, and this is what's one of the troubles of translation, is when you're translating, you're also interpreting. And when you're interpreting, you're making a choice. Like, you have to kind of try to decide how you want to, you know, how you want something to say or communicate. And so some English translations will take that word in 1 Corinthians 6, 9, and they'll just drop in homosexuals. Mm. And what Paul's doing there is he's listing off a number of actions that if a person engages in, renders them incompatible with what he calls the kingdom of God, which is a callback to Jesus's way to talk about God's work being done on earth as it is in heaven, this sort of unveiling of the dream of creation. And so Paul says, if you read this list, this vice list, you see this movement of sexual sins going into economic sins. And so you have idolatry and adultery, and then it moves into thievery and greed. And so right in the middle of this transition between sexual sins and economic sins is you have these two Greek words, arsenikoite and malakoi. And malakoi literally just means soft, often used to describe clothing, but in a pejorative sense, it was used to describe sort of the recipient in an sexual encounter, the receiver, the soft one. And then arsenikoite was probably intended to mean sort of the active partner. Now, what I'm not suggesting here is that Paul was not talking about two men having sex. Yes, he was, right? So this isn't some like attempt to get out of the fact that Paul in his mind was writing about two men having sex. Yeah, we can name that because that's what he was writing. That's what these words are pointing at. But what I have problems with is then making the jump from that to say, okay, now just being, so this is, I was going back to how some translations just translate it as homosexual. Well, now that word, that English word points to a person's identity. Like who I am. Mm-hmm. If someone just reads that a homosexual cannot inherit the kingdom of God, now they're just like, oh, because I have these inborn, innate desires and attractions, because I'm attracted to people of the same sex, you're telling me that I can't be a part of the kingdom of God? Mm-hmm. Like, that's problematic for all sorts of reasons. And then other translations will go with homosexuality, which is like this, you know, an orientation or pointing at acting on it. So then if you act on whatever your desires are. So even in our translations, we can't decide, are we talking about a person's identity? Or are we talking about actions? So I think what Paul's doing, and I talk about this in the books, I think he is connecting sexual sins with economic sins. And I think he's describing men who engage in sex that is exploitive in nature, or where there's like a payment for, so it's like prostitution, or where there's this exploitation, massive imbalance, where people are with great power and authority are sort of forcing in that case, usually young men to sort of engage and indulge in these sexual practices. Again, not about orientation and not about people of the same, like being in a loving, committed relationship with each other. This is just not what Paul was addressing. And then Romans was my hardest chapter to write. It was the last one that I wrote because it was one of those where it was the kind of the scariest one for me. Because I wanted to make sure that I did it justice, because I think this is the one that most people sort of hold up as, well, sure, you can do what you want with all the other ones, but Paul's so clear right here. Yeah. And for me, and again, the audience will just have to probably go read, because I can't fully unpack it here. But the beautiful thing that you can notice about Romans is you have to zoom out and you have to get a larger picture of what Paul is doing in this letter that he's writing to a church in Rome. Now, many of us maybe grew up or went to churches where Romans was seen as this theological document that Paul wrote for the church to just have for all time, but it wasn't. Like, this was a real letter that he wrote to a real church. And what you learn through, again, through these tools that we talked about earlier of evangelical exegesis, you learn through studying the history of what was going on in that time in Rome, through studying the way that Paul writes, the rhetorical moves that he makes, through putting the larger context of the letter together, what you realize is that Paul's writing a letter to a church that's fractured along ethnic lines. The church in Rome is split between Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. And maybe you could say the whole point of the letter was to get these communities to unify, to live in harmony, as he writes, with one another, to find peace, to figure out how to make space for one another. And why that matters, Fred, is because that larger understanding gives you insight into what Paul does in the opening chapter of his letter, what we call a chapter. He didn't have chapters. And what Paul, with the clobber passage sits inside of this larger 18 verse chunk from Romans 1, 17 all the way to verse 32. And in this chunk of verses, what I argue in the book is these verses aren't Paul saying, here's what I think about Gentiles.
Right.
Because what you read is you read this nonstop litany of the reasons why Gentiles are horrible people. Like, they've turned their back on God. They've forsaken it. And God has given them over to the due penalty of their error. And here's all the ways that Gentiles are horrible. This isn't Paul sort of saying, yeah, I agree with all of this. This is how bad Gentiles are. What Paul's doing is he's setting a trap that he springs at the beginning of chapter 2 for the Jewish Christians. And what he's doing is he's bringing to the surface the prejudices that are held within many of the Jewish Christians at that time. These prejudices that Gentiles are inferior, that they are a second class, that they are uniquely damaged goods, if you will. And Paul's bringing all that prejudice to the surface so that then he can flip it and now speak directly at the Jewish Christians in the church in Rome and say, actually, you, in your judgmental attitude, that's actually the problem. That's the thing that we need to address here. And so even looking at the clobber passage, Romans 1, 26, 27, this isn't even Paul saying his thoughts on the matter. It's him sort of, you might imagine him, he's kind of like pseudo writing. He's borrowing from this book called The Wisdom of Solomon, which was this well-known, well-circulated Jewish book in that era that was all about how bad the Gentiles were. He was using themes from that to point to these judgmental attitudes. And there's a lot more that could be said about that, but that's kind of the bigger thing is that no, Paul's not even addressing homosexuality, obviously. And he's not even addressing his thoughts on the matter. What he's doing is he's exposing common held beliefs about Gentiles that are within Jewish people so that he can then say, stop being so judgmental.
Yeah, great job. Well, I haven't known too many worship leaders through the years who do such great exegesis. So,
well, I was worship leading was for me, just, it was a means to an end, right? Like the music for me, it was about connecting to God and getting to know Jesus. And so I've been a I've been a thinker and a writer long before I was a musician. I just happened to use music for a number of years as a way to make that connection.
That's great stuff. Thank you so much. So I want to just refer people to this book, because many of you who are probably listening, we've had conversations about this. Colby's book, just take time, read through these arguments, and I think it'll help you begin to have what happened to Colby, what happened to me, is our heart and our head start aligning when all of a sudden we can be free to love and affirm people for who they are. And that's so powerful. And I think it's needed in the church today. And I would ask all of my conservative Catholic, conservative evangelical, and conservative Christians of all sorts and types to reconsider this, because we've done a lot of harm to the community. And and so that's our biggest heart, is to try to begin to undo, or at least begin a new beginning to where we have churches who are truly loving people at their deepest level and who they are. Thank you for that, Colby. So I'm curious, this book came out in 2017, I think, in that
about 16. Right? Yep, 2016.
Okay. And a lot's happened in your life since then. The book kind of ended sort of with this, you're starting a new church in San Diego, and there's a lot of idealism, and man, we've found a place to belong.
Yeah.
And a lot's happened since then, 2017. Well, give me one or two or three things that have changed for you since you wrote Unclobbered
in
your story.
Yeah. Yeah. So the book came out in
issue of Unclobbered, but it could also relate to your bigger trajectory and maybe what, if we do another interview on your new book, The Shift, that gets us into some of that as well. Right.
Yeah.
Because you could have wrote Unclobbered as a conservative Christian who remained a conservative Christian. Right. But it was hard to, I mean, the way you tackled the verses, the clobber verses.
Yes. Yes.
Was a very, you know, I mean, my conservative evangelical professors who taught me exegesis could go right along with you in the way you
handle things. That's right.
Yeah. But you're in a bit of a different trajectory now, is what I would assume, right?
Yeah.
What's changed? Give me two.
Oh, so much has changed, Fred. So yeah, I wrote the book in 2015. It came out in 2016. And that was 2 years into a church that we started here in San Diego back in 2014 called Sojourn Grace Collective. And that was, you know, that was our attempt to really experiment with, can we create a community of people organized around and committed to a shared value of living in the way of Jesus and practicing things like compassion and kindness and mercy and grace. You know, we were affirming and inclusive from day one. That was never a question, but can we build a faith community around that? That also holds space for all kinds of, diversity of thought, and belief, and where you didn't, you know, we didn't have a traditional belief statement. If you went to our church's website and you went to like about us and what we believe, we would list things that we believe about you. We believe that you are a loved child of God. We believe that you are good and beautiful. Right. So, so we started that in 2014, and, we just closed that about a year and a half ago. So ultimately, after about almost a 9-year run, we closed it down. The headline for that is we kind of just didn't survive the pandemic. We went virtual for 2 years, found a really cool way to do ministry online and really expand our reach in many ways through doing virtual church. But ultimately our board wanted us to get back to meeting in person, which I understand. We were a local church. And what we discovered is that the obstacle to building the church back in person model was just too great. It would have felt like starting over again. And after doing, at that point, I'd been a pastor for 20 years. I just didn't have it in me to start over again. And so we just did the compassionate thing. And we said, let's put this to rest. It was a beautiful, you know, we live in a culture where where anything that ends is seen as a failure. And I just think that's so absurd because, first of all, everything ends. Everything ends. Like, we know this, nothing lasts forever. So therefore, we can't just call things that end a failure. And that was also, but more to the point, those 9 years of doing that church was the greatest ministry of my life. I mean, it was unbelievable the number of lives that we touched and people that were transformed as a result of this work. So I'm not doing that anymore. You know, for the first time in 20 years, my Sunday mornings are open. So I've been doing a lot of traveling actually now, a lot of traveling and speaking and getting to visit faith communities around the country, which has just been a huge gift and a huge blessing. Not only does it allow me to still preach from time to time, which I love, but it gets me like in the pews with people and like getting to still do some of that pastoral work that I love so much. But yeah, the world that I move in now is often called progressive Christianity, mm-hmm. which I think is a helpful term in some ways. It was more helpful, I think, 4 years ago. I think it's less helpful now because this term progressive has so much political and ideological baggage to it that doesn't always do a great service to, I think, the kind of faith that myself and many of us are talking about. But, you know, to be progressive now is at least to be inclusive of LGBTQ people. It's at least to be egalitarian insofar as men and women are equals. It is at least to acknowledge that there is that science is a friend to faith and not an enemy, right? That if something is true in psychology and biology and anthropology, like these are all truths that can be held within the larger truth of whatever it means that there is a God. And then to be progressive also means that we think that the best days are in front of us, right? We're not trying to go backwards to some magical period in time in the past, but we're like, no, we can continue to create a world that is more compassionate, more kind, more just, more generous. And so I want to be a part of that movement. So that's a lot of what I do now. I still write a ton online. People can find my work online, working on the next book and traveling and speaking and Who knows what's next? Because the other big thing I people may not know about me, which is fine. Why would they? But right about the time that we closed our church, also my marriage of 19 years ended. Mm-hmm. So I'm, you know, the last year and a half, almost two, has been for me a exploration of identity. Who am I if I'm not Pastor Colby? Who am I if I'm not husband Colby? Who am I if I'm not Father Colby? Which obviously I'm still father to my kids, but not at the same level anymore, right? I don't live with them full time anymore. So my life has been radically altered in the last couple of years. And I don't know, it's terrifying and also really exhilarating at the same time, because at the end of the day, I'm still a loved child of God. Nothing I can do about that. And that's good news.
I felt like an atheist in 2019 when I, you know, lost pretty much everything except my life. So the darkness of those days still haunts me, but, I did hang on to God. I kind of rethought all of that, probably more of a process, certainly open relational process type concept of God. And, always leaned that way. You know, I was never a Calvinist, you know, but
yeah.
But then also, the mindful meditation has been really, really helpful for me. And so I was always a broad reader. I was always a good thinker. I always gravitate, even though I'd had a radical conversion at 16 and, felt called to be a pastor at the age of 16. So that's identity for all these years. And then all of a sudden it wasn't, and I don't even have any kids, Colby. So like a 37 year marriage ended, no kid, no church. The church I'd spent 30 years building is gone. I mean, gone for me.
And then
trying to reemerge and all of that, and who am I and what am I? And that's been a process. And I just decided to be honest with everybody about it. So you can read my blogs and listen to podcasts and And it's been a crazy thing. So for different reasons, I had a meltdown that totally different than you, but in terms of some of the challenges of that, you know, I can certainly connect at least to the identity challenges.
Yeah. Yeah.
Things like that. I had my mom and dad are still alive. They're 88 and 87. My three sisters, my brother-in-laws, my nephews and nieces pretty much all went to my church. I have now 17 great nephews and nieces. Most of them were dedicated at my former church. And it was a pretty big meltdown, you know, and very public. So, on that latter part of your experience, I can, at least there'd be parts that intersect a little bit, but the hope that I think you've just pointed to is that the foundation is that this, I like to call uncontrolling love of God that is there all the time.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing we can bank on. And I think it's the one thing that can connect us and help us belong at a deep, deep level.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That we all need. We're all here to be connected and to not to face this world alone. And I think isolation's a big threat these days. You know, I found my church home for a couple of years in the AA and in the Black church. And those were my two places to just be real and honest and vulnerable. And that's where I still love that. Still hang out in those spaces as well.
Yeah.
But pastoring again was hard.
I can imagine. Yeah.
It was just like, holy crap, what do I even believe? And, you know, it's like, it was weird, but I think it's what I think I'm still supposed to do it, you know? So, it's been an interesting journey. So help people connect with what you're doing. I noticed you landed in St. Louis not too long ago, and I'm thinking,
yeah, I was just in your neck of the woods, man.
We got to get you to the better half of the state, the west.
Okay. Okay. Oh, shots fired.
Way better. I mean, you can't be hanging out with those Cardinal fans. You got to get with the Chiefs. Like Mahomes is really cool right now. You know, like Kelsey and Taylor Swift and Mahomes.
Now explain to me, Fred, how come you went from, you can't hang out with those Cardinals fans. Yeah. And then instead of going to Royals, which would be the natural, you skipped right over that and went to the winning program. Interesting move you made there. I saw what you did.
You know, we won the World Series in 2015. You know, it took us 50 years after 85, then 15, then now it's like, yeah, we're at the bottom of the barrel again, losing 100 games a year and like, oh, crap, you know. So, yeah, Chiefs, way to go, yes. Chiefs.
No, I'd love to make it to Kansas City someday for sure.
And how do people connect with you? Tell your, what's your Instagram, your website, your books, Unclobbered and The Shift are the two books. Yeah. Go to Amazon there.
Sure.
Your website is what?
Yeah, my website is ColbyMartinOnline.com. Really, you can just Google my name and I take up most of the front page because the name's kind of unique. There was a guy last year who was like convicted of this really, really horrible crime. So for a while there, like his story was populating the front page of Google. But I think the universe has recalibrated a bit and that story has gone away. Thankfully, I'm like, oh, that's embarrassing. No, not the same guy. So yeah, you can just Google my name and it'll take you to anywhere you want. My website, Instagram, my Substack. So all my writing right now is over on Substack at perspectiveshift.co. And I publish several articles a week as I'm writing about all sorts of topics these days.
Cool. I am going to be at the Persuade conference in Denver in April here in a few weeks with the After Deconstruction. It's, I think, Tripp and Tom Ward are going to be there.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Chapter in that book that's coming out on the open and relational book. I can't remember. I think it's called Persuade, but it's a kind of open process sermons and stuff like that.
Very cool.
Then I'm writing a memoir, and then I'm going to be at Wild Goose this summer and probably the beer camp in the fall.
Great.
So maybe our paths will cross. And
absolutely.
I've been thinking, I'm really connected with the DOC now in Kansas City, and the regional overseer is a dear friend and been very supportive of my journey here over the last 4 or 5 years. And I definitely would like to get you and like maybe like Stan Mitchell, Paula Stone Williams to city and do some kind of a conference or something like that, because it's, and there's still people wrestling with all these issues. You know, we've kind of moved past, you know, I mean, once you kind of work through it all and you take the hits and make the sacrifices for your beliefs, you find a new crowd. Right. But still, I still have a lot of people who are listening and following and wrestling with these passages still. So thank you for taking the time.
Yeah. And to that point, I mean, you're exactly right. This book Unclobber has sold, it sells more each year than the year before it. I would have, thought that we would have hit this kind of turning point. We just haven't yet. There's still majority of churches are still non-affirming, and therefore majority of Christians are still non-affirming. So there's still the harvest is plenty, man, but the labors are few. So I'm so grateful for you and for your work. And yes, if you ever want to organize or rally something happening in your part of the world, I'll be there in a heartbeat. If nothing else, just because I got to come taste some Kansas City barbecue. Has to happen.
Right. Exactly. All right. Well, thank you for being on Spirituality Adventures. Thanks for everybody tuning in, and we will see you next time.
Thank you, Fred.
Hey, you made it to the end. Thanks for listening all the way through on this episode. By the way, if you're not already a supporter, go to spiritualityadventures.com, sign up for one of our monthly supports, and you will receive our bonus content. You'll receive lots of interesting information about our guests. Many of our musicians will do special bonus songs and record a song. So I want to encourage you to do that. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Be sure and subscribe. Be sure and share any of the episodes that you like. And be sure and make comments if you like them as well. This helps us get Spirituality Adventures out there to more listeners, more watchers. So whatever platform you're using, subscribe, like, share, make comments, and go to our website, sign up for our team and be a part of the team support. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.